So this is work I've been doing in collaboration with colleagues in Leeds, Celine Gavini and Chris Jones. And it's a bit of a byproduct from what we thought we were doing. So what we intended to do, which is what we're still doing, is to look at dynamo action in rotating convection and to try to understand large versus small scale dynamo action. And as a kind of precursor to that, we obviously had to study convection. We thought just to get, you know, the basic states that we could then look at their MHD properties. And we found what we thought was of some interest in the purely convection problem, in the pure hydro problem. So that's what I'm going to talk about here. We've already heard some talks from Gregory Falkovich on, for example, on formation of large-scale vortices in 3D flows, and this is another different example of that. Okay, and we also heard yesterday from Michael Culkins is it working or is it not? Right. Now is it working? Yes. Okay, so all of that introductory stuff passed over everyone. Doesn't matter. The important thing is that just a lot of this was done by Celine Gavili, so she should be acknowledged suitably. Okay, so we heard yesterday, as I was saying, I think, about, you know, the importance of convection in a whole range of astro and geophysical problems. Okay, so what we... I mean, the slide on the front here gives the game away. We have a large spot, colored red, obviously, which is formed in our rotating convection. So the question is, really, how come? I mean, in the MHD problem, there's a lot of... One of the great difficulties in MHD is why small scale... is how you get large scale anything. How do you get large-scale magnetic fields from small-scale flows and small-scale fields? How do they conspire? There's a beautiful theory, mean field theory, which describes it, if only it happened. Okay. And so it's of interest that in hydro, various hydro situations, it seems to happen, whereas in MHD, it's a very difficult thing to realize, it seems. Okay. So these are vortices in convection have been found in previous numerical experiments, but not in many. Considering how many numerical experiments of convection there are out there, rotating convection, plane layer convection I'm talking about, then it's surprising that we found it surprising that we could find very few references to the formation of large-scale structures. Though, as will maybe become clear, you can see why, we will be able to see why that might be so. So recent ones, this is work of Chan and Meyer, these two pictures. So they studied compressible convection, and they found, depending on where they were in parameter space, but particularly depending on what the Rossby number was, they found they could either get large-scale cyclones like this, or, well, you can't see it's a cyclone, but cyclones for which there was a negative temperature anomaly, or anticyclones for which there was a positive temperature anomaly. And work by Kepler et al. And the group in Nordita have also found similar things. So they're all compressible, and they have slightly complicated boundary conditions in that they have stable layers above and below the convective regions. And then I think maybe this picture was actually shown yesterday in a very different sort of model. This is the model that Michael Calkins described yesterday, the reduced model by Keith Julian, Edgar Knobloch, and that group, where it's assumed that the rotation is so fast that you can scale the, you can do a asymptotic analysis building on the small scale in the horizontal. They also find, Babusnes, they also find large-scale vortices. And in their model, they find both. And indeed, in their model, they have to find both. There can be no preference for cyclonic or anticyclonic behavior once you've got their reduced system. Okay. So that was the kind of, that's the other work. So this is what I'm going to talk about, the structure of these vortices, where they live in parameter space, why there should be, so what we find are cyclones, why there should be cyclones and not anticyclones or not both. Then I'm going to try and say something about what's driving them. Okay, why should there be this energy transfer to large scales? And possibly I will say something about the heat transfer, but if I'm going on too long, I should just not say anything about the heat transfer. But there's a lot of work, there's a lot of interest in scaling laws in convection, you know, how the Nusselt number scales with Rayleigh number, Taylor number, Prandtl number, etc., etc. So this is our setup. It's about the simplest thing you could do in convection. So it's Rayleigh-Bénard, Boussinesq convection in a box with the rotation about the vertical axis. Okay. These equations I'm sure we've seen before. So there's really there's three dimensionless parameters. We will only vary two of them. So there's the Rayleigh number, which is a measure of the driving, the Ekman number, which is an inverse measure of the rotation rate, if you think of it that way, and the Prandtl number, ratio diffusivities, which we will set to one. Okay, everything we do is Prandtl number equals one. And there's also, which is important, the aspect ratio of the box. Okay, so which we'll call lambda. So there's really three things. Having set the Prandtl number to one, there's three things we can vary. Okay. Boundary conditions are also important. So we've gone for what I suppose you might think is the simplest. It's the one you would do if you were doing the linear problem, for example, as an exercise with fixed temperature and stress-free. Okay, so the linear problem then decomposes nicely. It's also true that with these, you're probably giving yourself the best possible chance of getting something large-scale swirling motion. Right. So we're going to work actually not with the Rayleigh number as such, but with this compensated Rayleigh number. So in the limit of small Ekman number, the critical Rayleigh number scales like EK to the minus 4/3. So we work with a kind of compensated, more order one Rayleigh number in which we introduce the EK to the 4/3 like that. So this is a run with, that's the smallest Ekman number we do, 5 × 10⁻⁶, in a box of size one, okay? A box of size one, of course, has lots of cells in it, because the cell size varies with the Ekman number to the power third. And so you get lots of cells in a 1 by 1 by 1 box. And these two runs here show the URMS, which in these units is essentially the Reynolds number. Things are scaled with kappa, but Prandtl number is one, so this, you could think of this as Reynolds number. At two different values of the Rayleigh number. Okay, so the initial exponential growth is just the growth of the convective instability. Okay. And then it does, this one does the kind of honorable thing. It grows, saturates, and trundles along at that value, and that's that. Whereas this one, at a higher Rayleigh number, starts doing the honorable thing and then just keeps growing. Okay. And grows for a long time, on a long scale. Okay. And what that is, as we'll see, it's this bit here that is the growth of the large-scale vortex, okay? And it takes place on, well, possibly not a viscous time scale, but something, you know, as it says here, 10% of the viscous time scale. So we could look at what it's doing, possibly. So this is a movie of this top run all the way from here, somewhere down here, all the way up to the end. And it runs for, it doesn't run for a long time in real time, but it runs for a long of those. So it's a bit manic because I guess there aren't, if we had all the frames in, it would run forever in real time. So so it looks a bit manic to my view, but anyway. So this is the vorticity. This is the axial vorticity sliced somewhere in the box. And you can see, right, that it's, you can see, it's periodic, of course, so this guy belongs to this one. It would have been luckier if it had ended up in the middle of the box, but it didn't.
Red means hot.
No, red means cyclonic. This is vorticity. And blue. So at the beginning, there's obviously no, you can't tell anything, right? And then, eventually, you can just see it forming, and it drags in here. It drags in other bits of vorticity, and if we kept running it, it would look even more coherent. So by the end, you've got yourself a vortex which is essentially as big as the box. Okay. Overall, over the whole box, averaged, there can be no axial vorticity. Okay. So whatever is red concentrated has to be compensated by blue spread out in the surroundings. No, I think that's at a height, that one. I'll come to that in a minute. Actually, it looks the same. So just I could answer that question here. This is so this is a vertical slice. This is X and Z. So we were looking down at a slice across here, and you can see that whichever way you slice it, it's going to be, you know, this object, this cyclone, really does stretch through the entire extent of the box. Okay. Whereas so this is the one we were looking at. Whereas this is the smaller Rayleigh number, probably around here somewhere, where there is no coherent. There's kind of elements of blue of red, but there's equally elements of blue. Okay, there's no structure which stretches all the way across. There's no predominance of red over blue, really. So I think that's what it just says here. There's one vortex. It stretches the whole box, and it grows essentially to the size of the box. So if we doubled the size of the box, we'd expect this, I think, just to carry on growing. Right. So these are just, this isn't all that crucial. These are just, but maybe I should mention it. These are the parameter values that we looked at. Split into series. So we split them into series of a fixed Ekman number and a fixed aspect ratio, and then did a whole bunch of runs at different Rayleigh numbers within each of these. So each one of these series has a whole bunch of runs at different Rayleigh numbers. So any given series has a fixed, well, you can see it here. These are all the runs we did. And a given series has a fixed Ekman number and a fixed aspect ratio. So these are two, they're Rossby numbers, based either on the vertical flow or on the whole flow. Of course, in a given series here, we're keeping the Ekman number fixed. And so really, it's a measure of the vertical velocity or the full velocity. So the axis here is the Rayleigh number, and the vertical velocity just increases with Rayleigh number, as you might expect. The more you kick it, the more you put thermal driving into the system, the bigger the vertical velocity becomes. Whereas you can see that that's not true for the horizontal velocity. The total velocity, and of course, therefore, the horizontal velocity, which peaks and then decreases again, even though you're pushing the thermal driving harder. Okay. So there's clearly a difference just from that. You can see there's a difference somehow in between the vertical, the kinetic energy, the vertical flow, and the kinetic energy of the horizontal flow. So if we looked at that, so if we looked at this measure, gamma, which is a measure of the total kinetic energy over the kinetic energy of the vertical flow, what you see, okay, so this one at the bottom is a bit like that first one that I showed, where nothing really happens. So gamma is more or less 1 all the way through. There's as much energy in the horizontal as there is in the vertical. Whereas if we looked at, say, S5, which is this triangle one, or the S3, which is the square one, okay, so S3 is Ekman number in a bigger box. So the difference between the open squares and the filled squares, same parameter values, but a bigger box. You can see if you just make the box bigger, then there's this huge increase up to a factor of 10 or so in gamma. Okay, so the horizontal flows are becoming much more important here. So they become more important either through making the box bigger or through decreasing the Ekman number, which are these two runs. Okay. And this transition, okay, the transition for where this kicks in is about, in these is about 20. So it's not massively supercritical. RA is about 9 at when these things kick in. So what we would like to do is to try and get a measure of where in parameter space these things live. What is it that we need to get a large-scale vortex? So what we found, okay, is that so this is the same plot with a different axis, but not really that different. This is the Reynolds number in the vertical flow. Okay. Then it seems that we need the Reynolds number to be of the order of a few hundred, okay, before all these things kick off. Okay, so you need a sufficiently vigorous flow. Okay. But if it's too vigorous, of course, then it doesn't know about rotation. There obviously has to be a balance, and these things just come down again, and you just get non-rotational convection, really. So if we looked at the other end, I mean, what we were looking for was, are there measures such that we can pin the beginning and end of this regime regardless, you know, for all these runs? So this one, you can see, this is plotting gamma, the ratio of energies in the whole flow to the vertical flow, against a local Rossby number, okay? And you can see that all of them finish, you know, more or less about here, which is about 0.15, 0.2, regardless of the Ekman number, regardless of the aspect ratio, okay? So it seems, empirically at least, that we've got a kind of measure of where these things kick in, which is that the Reynolds number should be of order 100, and where they stop, which is that when the Rossby number becomes of order a tenth, okay? And in that regime, it seems that we can get coherent vortices, okay? So these are just plots of something really that I've already said. So these are horizontal cross-sections of the same parameter values, these at different aspect ratios. Okay, so this is the one we saw in the movie with a coherent spot. These are just smaller boxes where, at least by inspection, you would not say that there was, well, you may or may not for that one. That one you certainly wouldn't say there was a preference for cyclone or anticyclonic behavior. This is just a figure, a picture of the spectra to go along with those figures. But actually, there's much more in the spectra than there is in the figures. So if you looked at, you know, if you just look at this one, there is no, there's no obvious cyclone, right? There's no obvious preference for a conglomeration of red stuff over blue stuff. Whereas if you look, if you do actually look at, but there is certainly a collection of energy at large scale, okay, that doesn't at this stage say whether it's cyclonic or anticyclonic, but this, the black line here is lambda equals 1, lambda equals 2, lambda equals 4, so you can see that there is a growth of energy at the largest scales permitted in your box, and it becomes more pronounced. Well, the rest of the stuff just lives happily at the convective cell size and knows nothing about the box size. And then the, all of this, right, all of these, all of this spectra essentially lie on top of each other, even because they couldn't care less whether, you know, these are very small cells, so it doesn't matter whether it's 1, 2, or 4. It can't tell. But it's putting energy into the largest scale it can find, okay, and it's putting a lot of energy into the largest scale it can find. This is the spectrum of the vertical velocity, which again couldn't care less about the box size, right? All of these lie on top of each other. Right. Well, this is just a summary of where they live. I think I've probably said that. We need a suitably large Reynolds number. It's not massive. And we need a suitably small Rossby number. And it seems that if we have those, then we get energy transfer, quite marked energy transfer to the largest scale allowed in the box. Okay. So why should it be one rather than the other? Why should it be red rather than blue? Why should it be cyclonic rather than anticyclonic? Particularly, I mean, why is it that way in Boussinesq when it's not necessarily that way in compressible convection? That's an interesting question. So in compressible convection, like those pictures I showed at the beginning, if the Rossby number is very small, if you like, certainly in by simulation standards, then they get cyclones. If it's small, still much less than one, but not that small, then they get anticyclones, okay? So to get a measure, at least, to get a quantitative measure of this, so that, as I said, the integrated vorticity is zero over any horizontal cross-section. So we define, we work with the skewness, which will pick out, concentrations of one rather than the other. And with this definition, then it's positive if we get a concentration of cyclonic vorticity. So this is the skewness, vorticity skewness, against Rayleigh number or compensated Rayleigh number for the run with the smallest Ekman number that we've looked at. So down here, they are technically anticyclones, but it's hard really to. There's a lot of noise in that signal. Once it becomes clear over here, then clearly the skewness is positive. Okay, so all of these are cyclonic. Eventually, if we push this hard enough, we imagine this will come back down to zero. So we never get, I don't really know. Down here, it's not really safe to say anything. We don't really get anticyclones. Okay, so one assumes, just by the obvious, that's just a statement of the obvious, that there's some compressibility effects that are absolutely crucial for anticyclonic behavior. Right, so there's related work on, say, grid-generated turbulence in rotating systems, which favors cyclonic behavior. So why should it be? Well, there's sort of two possibilities that you could, you know, there's nothing very profound in this statement. You could argue that there is a general willingness of vorticity to congregate, okay? And so the likes, you know, cyclones, like sign vorticities would like to gang up with each other, which possibly is happening, but then the anticyclones are not stable, for example. That's one possibility. So the mechanism is there to generate them, but as soon as they're formed, they've had it, okay? So that's number two. I don't know why I did number two first. Or not. So that the actual mechanism itself favors, well, yeah, too many negatives, favors cyclones, okay? Well, you could do an experiment to to try and address this one to a certain extent. So what we could do, what we have done, is to take, this is the end product of the movie we saw before. So you could take it and seed it and turn everybody round. So you can turn red to blue, make sure you've fixed up all the horizontal averages so that they all make sense, and let it go. Okay. 5 minutes. Okay, thanks. So this is precisely that experiment. So we start with the great blue spot, and you can see that it doesn't like to exist, really. And in not too long a time, it turns itself into the great red spot. So that at least would seem to suggest that they're not stable. How come? So one possibility, of course, is that the system has its own vorticity, as it were, and what you might think of as planetary vorticity. Okay. So in a cyclone they combine, and in an anticyclone they work against each other. So in an anticyclone, the absolute vorticity can be quite small. So you might argue that the actual rotational effect in an anticyclone, for which the absolute vorticity is small, is negligible. So it can convect like crazy. Whereas in a cyclone, you've got rotational constraints on the convection, okay, which are less disruptive to the cyclone itself. I did mention this. I'll just mention it again because I think it's an interesting model. So this is the Julian et al. Model. It isn't actually. No, this is the real equation. This is the full equation. In the scaling, in the very rapidly rotating scaling, then this term is negligible compared to this term. And in that case, there's no preference for one or the other. So you have to have, if you get them, you have to get this picture, at least on average. You have to get as many cyclones as anticyclones. Okay, but we're obviously not rotating sufficiently quickly to be in that limit. We're in a case where these two numbers are comparable. Right, so maybe I'll just say a bit about energy transfer and I won't say anything about heat transport, but that's fine. So what is it? What's going on? So this is the vertical vorticity equation. So there's various things you could ask. You can ask, how does it matter that it's 3D? Because we all know in 2D, this is exactly what you'd expect. In 2D turbulence, energy to large scales is as expected, okay? Or is the 3D-ness essential? Now, is it, you know, and if it is, which scales matter? Okay. And that's not a very easy question to answer. So this is just what the kinetic energy looks like. Okay, I've kind of said this already. As you increase the Rayleigh number, you push more and more up to large scales. This is a more revealing picture, possibly. So this is what the mode-by-mode energy looks like. Okay, so in this particular case, there's three modes, I think, that are linearly unstable, or possibly four, which are these. So these are unstable in the linear regime. These are not, but they're dragged up non-linearly once these become sufficiently large amplitude. And then everybody saturates except one. Okay, so all modes saturate here except kh equals 1, which grows. Eventually, of course, it saturates. Okay, it's never easy, in my opinion, to actually... It's one thing to say, ha-ha, we've got this big thing, and it's another question to say, and how did we get it? Okay. So one thing you can do, it's not perfect, but it's not a bad thing to do, I believe, is to artificially constrain your flow to throw out certain modes to see if with the modes that you've got left, you get the behavior that you get in the full system. Okay. So for example, so these are, we've done a whole bunch of these. These are just four filtrations, if you like. So that's the full system, and that's the ratio, in the full system, that's the ratio of the energy in the kH equals one mode to everybody else, and it's high. You can see it's very high, 0.81. So we did a bunch of filtrations, which is to keep the kz, these are modes retained, okay? So we keep the kz equals naught, and for kz equals naught, we keep kh equals one and nobody else, and for kz not equals naught, we keep everybody, for example, or we keep kz equals naught, kh equals one, kz not equals naught, keep everybody but six, everybody over 15, everybody over 21. So you're throwing away more and more of your spectrum to see what it is, at least in this artificially constructed system, what it is that's driving the growth of the kh equals one mode. So this is the kh, this is the full one, the black one. The best fit, if you like, is the red one. So what do we learn? We learn that this case D is not good. So case D, we've obviously thrown away too much. We've cut off so many modes that it's not working. On the other hand, things like B, you've thrown away a lot of modes there. You've thrown away all the modes from 1 to 15, and you get a good representation in terms of this number of the whole system. Okay. Also, we clearly don't need just the kz equals naught modes. We've thrown all of those away. Okay, so it's not, you have to be careful what you say, but you can get the answer certainly without resorting to a 2D inverse cascade, okay? And you can get the answer by cutting away lots of intermediate wave numbers, okay? So it looks as if it's ripe for what, you know, a standard mean field theory approach of small scale directly onto the large scale modes, and that's what I'm going not to talk about. So conclusions. Well, I didn't do the third one. So provided we're in this regime, sufficiently high Reynolds number but sufficiently low Rossby number, we get large scale structures, and they're always cyclonic. Okay. And it seems that they're actually produced by small-scale, Z-dependent motions. Okay. and that one I didn't mention, so I'll stop there. Thank you.
Questions?
David.
Andrew.
I was just wondering whether you'd consider a double limit. If you let lambda go to infinity, then you might, in the weakly non-linear regime, get this effect. In other words, you could look at it as stability. Then you could look at it as a sort of stability problem, because you've got an arbitrary geostrophic flow, which could then possibly ride on the convection. In other words, with the convection at low altitude, you could look at the interactions to see if the geostrophic flow was self-sustaining in certain modes.
Mm. No, well, that's an interesting suggestion. No, we haven't, but I can believe that in that limit, you could recover it. Yeah.
I mean, you get a little bit of that sort of situation in MHD problems when you're worrying about things like Taylor's constraint, things like that.
Mm.
This possibility arises.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting idea. Yeah.
David, did you say what the temperature perturbation is inside these cyclones? I mean, are they hot or cold cores?
No, I didn't, because I was going too slowly. But thank you, Gary. right, so there. As a snapshot, they look, so if we looked at the heat flux, for example, at the surface, of course, we have fixed temperature boundary conditions. If we looked at the heat flux, then that's a snapshot. This one is a cyclone that doesn't move, so we can do time averaging. So this is quite clear. So this is, blue, of course, is cooler. So there's, it's cool in the vortex, and these are the profiles of temperature taken. You can see. So the solid line is taken at 1.82, which is bang in the middle of the cyclone, and the other one is taken somewhere over here in the anticyclonic sea outside. So there's a clear difference in the temperature profile, leading to a clear difference in the heat flux. So our cyclones are cooler, which is also interesting compared to the Julian et al. Results, where their both cyclones and anticyclones are hotter, which we don't understand, but maybe Michael understands. So,
sorry, I have a question here. If you scale up your box to the size of an entire star, what would these spots look like?
Well,
you said they go all the way up to the largest possible scale.
Yeah. Well, if I scaled it up to a cubic star, they would look like this. If I scaled it up to a spherical star, then of course things start looking different. Because then you start meeting. So you probably don't get them. I mean, I think the argument is that they become spread out and you get jets. So it wouldn't look like this. I'm pretty sure it wouldn't look like this.
Are these cyclone or anticyclone convert kinetic energy into potential energy?
Do they convert?
Do they convert kinetic energy into potential energy, or the reverse way?
I don't know if I understand that. Well,
I mean the cyclone, the big vortices, they get energy from smaller vortices.
Yes.
By inverse cascade, and this seems to convert kinetic energy into potential energy.
Well, it's converting kinetic energy into kinetic energy.
No, potential energy. It seems it suppresses the convection.
It
has a secondary circulation, which...
It suppresses the convection.
But beyond that, does it convert kinetic energy into potential energy? Like increasing the temperature? Okay.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Yeah. You could see, you mean from here,
Convection decreases potential.
Final question, Jeff.
Is there any laboratory confirmation of this phenomena? It seems like you could get a high Rayleigh number in the lab.
In convection?
In rotating convection.
Yeah, I don't know of any.
I mean, people do rotate in convection. You could just ask John Arnault or Bob Becky or somebody who does it.
Yes.
Might be worthwhile.
It's probably irrelevant to the experiments that I spoke about.
Very final question.
To excite the turbulence that I was talking about at the land.
Okay. Yes.
So as a comment on the previous comment, these look a lot like Taylor columns that have been seen in rotating convection, and notably like John Arnault and his student Eric King did some nice work on that, so that might be some relevance.
That's right, they are, yes. Yeah. They're a conglomeration of Taylor columns, if you like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We need to move on now. Thank you again, David.